This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Hobbit Holes, Burrows and Secret Lairs, the concept of home in speculative fiction.
Now, this is actually quite a big topic.
Yes.
I'm surprised we haven't actually handled it before, to be honest.
I think we've sort of brushed past the edges when we were talking about things like found family, but no, we've never really gone into the fact that home directly relates into lots of different threads of speculative fiction. And it's everything from a small scale, I just want to go home, so I guess I'll fight this dragon in the hopes that I can do it, individual perspective, to a planet-wide evacuation where people quest across the stars looking for a new planet to inhabit, like Battlestar Galactica.
It's true that within fiction, and particularly within speculative fiction, the theme of home is often very prevalent. Yeah, it's very prevalent. I think that's because, going on a very small tangent, you know, we've discussed in the past how the way that we are able to connect with sci-fi and with fantasy is through themes and subplots which feel familiar to us. And it's no wonder that we see the subject of home and finding home in so much literature, because it is actually something that I think that everybody faces in one way or another, that search for home.
Yeah, definitely. And I suppose that's really brings us on to why is home, home as a concept, important. And the thing is, home is not a house. It's not a collection of bricks and mortar. Home is a place to belong. And it might be a physical place, or it might not be. Or it could be as amorphous as you belong in this particular land or county. And you know, you never really quite feel you're at home if you live somewhere else. Or maybe home is finding the empty place inside yourself and the right thing to fill it with. Maybe that's what it is. So it's quite an amorphous, nebulous concept.
Yeah. What does home mean to you, Jules? What's home for you?
It is a tricky one, really, isn't it? For me, home could be as simple as one room, as long as it's got, you know, books and things in it. But no, home, all joking aside, home is a connection with the land for me, and that probably sounds quite pretentious, so I apologise for anything I'm about to say.
Oh no.
I once had this discussion with my English literature teacher, a lecturer from A-level, and, you know, occasionally we still meet up and have a drink together and chat about things. And I can't remember how we got onto the subject, but I was talking about how, as a teenager, I'd gone back to my family's home in Ireland, and the sense that even though I'd not spent much time there, that coming away from those hills would leave me feeling homesick for them for the rest of my life. And it's true, it has in some respects. And I kind of made him cry, I'm not sure how.
Aww, Jules.
Because I then went, oh God, that was such an incredibly pretentious thing to say. But he was like, no, I genuinely don't think we register enough that we have a connection to the land of our birth, if you like. And obviously I wasn't physically born there, but, you know, where we come from, where our roots come from. And there's a connection there that, you know, can't really be defined in physical terms like, well, I built a house there or I was born there. It's just that's kind of where you belong.
Yeah,
that probably doesn't make a lot of sense and nonsense.
No, it does, because I feel very similarly about the place in France where my family are from.
Yeah.
I have a very deep connection to that area, and obviously that connection has only grown, because obviously that's where my mother's buried, and my grandfather, and a lot of old family. There's this real sense of history there as well, and there's the sense of peace that I only get there and nowhere else.
Yeah, so it's, you know, it runs deeper than you can really define, I think. And there are other places that I feel like that about. For my university years, Aberystwyth did feel like home to me. I had that same connection with the land around there. And Dorset, particularly around Bull Barrow, felt like home as well. Obviously, I didn't live on Bull Barrow. It'd be pretty much impossible to live on Bull Barrow. It doesn't like people very much.
If anyone could live on Bull Barrow.
If anyone could, it would be me. But it's not really possible. It would be horrendously cold during the winter. It's almost a mountain. I took Madeline up there once and I don't think you had quite the same reaction to it I did.
We got chased out.
We didn't get chased out. We were up on the burial mounds, the tumuli up there.
We got chased off.
Did not.
Yeah, we bloody well did.
I felt welcome, but it was also a very windy, muddy day, as I recall.
So we got chased off by the wind.
So there you go. It's the connection with, for me, it's the connection with land, closely followed by a room full of books. But for other people, home might be a big family. I do look at some people who have really, really big families that have this, despite squabbling and rivalry within the family, they still have this huge, warm, loving family and everybody's out for everybody else. And I look at them and I sort of marvel because I just don't want anything like that for myself. But at the same time, I kind of admire it from the outside as well.
I just love it. It's just like, oh, isn't this a beautiful scene? Yeah, this is literal hell.
Well, I mean, it's like looking at those Norman Rockwell paintings, isn't it? Where you're kind of like, wow, that's just idyllic. It's beautiful. And I feel kind of claustrophobic imagining myself in that scene. Whereas other people might look at it with real longing and think, that's where I want to be. That's what I want. And, you know, both perspectives, absolutely fine. I think it's because I can never imagine myself fitting in with that many people. So it's kind of like, oh, no, I don't think so.
Yeah, I think I like sort of visiting family and seeing family and lots of them. But, you know, like I can only deal with it for a short period of time.
Yeah,
I get a bit funny.
I suppose the weird thing is I've probably been better with huge gatherings of my more distant family, so my family in Ireland, who I haven't really seen very much of for most of my life. So there's great big leaps of 10 years and things in between seeing each other, and yet I'm better with a crowd of them than I am with a crowd of more immediate family in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I get what you mean. My brother just got married.
Yep. Obviously, congratulations. Jonathan, if you're listening.
He's not. But, yeah, congratulations to you, Jonathan, and to Kat. And we had people coming from all over, literally all over. A lot, obviously, we had all the clansmen from France and from Newcastle. And from all sorts of places, and it was really funny, because of course what it meant was half of the congregation were French, and when Kat and Jonathan were setting up tables, they were like, "Oh Christ, we need to make sure there's at least one bilingual person on every single table, otherwise we're gonna have serious trouble." So yes, I was the appointed bilingual on my table. It was rather amusing. I spent most of the night translating. But actually, as an experience, it was funny. And you know, when you suggested the episode of home, I was thinking, you know, I've obviously been thinking about this wedding and I've been organising photographs and stuff with it. And I kept thinking about, you know, we were in this place that was totally unfamiliar. Half of the people there I didn't know. And yet, there was this sense. It was the most beautiful wedding I've ever been to. And yeah, I have been to some really lovely ones. You know, Charlotte and Ashley's wedding was also fantastic that I went to earlier in the year. And probably because this is my brother, I just felt even more keenly this humongous sense of love and camaraderie, which isn't actually always. You say, oh, you know, a wedding is full to the brim of love. And it isn't always, to be honest.
No, I've been to a few and I'm just like, I'm politely waiting until it's time to leave, almost.
Yeah, whereas this was... It felt like home. It felt like one of those, you know, families literally coming together and really coming together and caring about each other and loving each other. And it was an amazing experience. It really, really was. I really enjoyed it. I cried pretty much the whole way through the through the vows and things like that. From the moment like the music started, that was it. I was gone. I was sobbing the entire time. The bride glared at me because I was almost making her sob. She was like, "Stop it! Stop crying!" But it was really beautiful. And I suddenly thought, "Yeah, this is what home is." For me, at the very least, home is this feeling of family, and it's not actually necessarily the number of people, and it's not actually necessarily us all being together in one place. Because, as I've mentioned before. I went to boarding school at a very young age, my brother and I, so we're quite close because my parents were across the ocean. The closest they ever lived to us was Holland. Otherwise, you know, the furthest they lived was in Bangladesh. So it was a considerable way away. And in the beginning years, we were very limited in how we could talk to them. We didn't have mobile phones. We could only talk to them at certain times of the night, and there was always queues for the phones and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we'd go months at a time without seeing any of our family at all, apart from each other, which only meant that when we were together, there was this great sense of, well, there's no other word for it, home. And this was for a family who were constantly moving, constantly. We never really stayed in one place. And I had this huge crisis when I was younger, where I just said to my mum, I don't know where home is, and I don't know where I belong, because so many people kept saying, "Where are you from?" And I literally didn't know how to answer where I was from, because I was born in London. They're like, "Where are you born?" I was like, "I was born in London, but I'm not from London." Like, up until that point, you know, up until recently, I'd barely spent any time in London at all. And even now, you know, I've barely spent any time in London. I would not call it my home. I don't have a claim on it in any shape or form. So as kids, it was really confusing. I didn't know where I was from, and it was very difficult to say I'm just from my family. And this is the moment where you realize that home is so largely tied in with your identity. And actually trying to simplify what home is can really complicate how you feel. And it's just not easy, especially when you're younger. So yeah, it's a huge part of your identity, I feel, home.
Yeah, and it's, as you say, a huge part of your identity, which it can mean security, it can mean safety, it can mean a place to belong or relax. It can be territory, it can be as simple as territory, and it can be family as well, or friends, you know, found family. And conversely, that's why homelessness is actually so devastating. And I'm going to we will talk about the speculative fiction elements in it, but I've done a little bit of voluntary work for the homelessness charity Shelter. And as of this recording, there is an estimated 300,000 people homeless in the UK, which is approximately one in every 200 people.
God.
I suppose the thing is, people have this idea that being homeless means that you're some sort of junkie or you're drunk, and you're living on the streets of a city using a cardboard box, and you are basically the dregs, and it's kind of your fault that you're there. But the thing is, anybody can be made homeless. You know, a string of circumstances that, you know, can be things that happen to you can make you homeless. Or some people choose to be homeless rather than stay in a home that's unsafe to them for any sort of reason. And homeless can mean sofa surfing. So it can mean sort of staying with one friend, and then another, and never really having a place that's your own.
Yeah.
Or it can mean sort of wintering in somebody's shed, doing odd jobs for them on their small holding or whatever, and basically being an unpaid servant, almost, in order just to have a roof over your head during the cold months. So homelessness is not as cut and dried as people think it is. And, certainly it's only a minority of people who are homeless and actively using illegal substances. And even then, why are they using... Are they homeless because they've spent all their money on drugs, or are they using drugs because life is actually not very appealing and any escape is desirable, yeah. No matter how bad it is? So
they did a very, very small tangent there. Just because this argument really annoys me. It's just that, oh, you know, they're druggies and stuff like that. They don't deserve care. And I'm like, you know what? It doesn't matter what you are. Everyone deserves a certain level of care. But they did experiments on rats where they got them addicted to either cocaine or heroin. I feel kind of sorry for rats. We're not very nice to them. And they said, oh, there you go. If once a rat was sort of introduced to the substance, they would just keep returning to it over and over and over again until it killed them. Until someone pointed out, yeah, but hold on a second. You've put this rat in a cage with absolutely nothing else in it.
Yeah.
And so they redid the experiment with several rats in the cage, and there was lots of stimuli. There was the social element, because rats are quite social. There was lots of things for them to do. There was plenty of food. It was a no stress environment. And they actually found that the rats barely, if not at all, returned to the drugs.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me at all.
Yeah, and it really is this element that drugs are a form of escapism. Yes, there are going to be a few people who are just using it, but you know what? You cannot paint everybody with one, you know, stroke of the brush just because you don't happen to approve of something. And if you think about how vital home is and what it means, not just for security, but as we said, for identity, for the feel of worth as well that comes with it.
Yeah.
It's vital.
And it's even more basic than that, because how many things can you think of? How many benefits, things like opening a bank account, starting a new job, getting a library card, how many can you think of that don't require a fixed address?
Well, I got chatting with a few homeless people who live in Winchester. And one of the main problems was that they were qualified. They could do work, but they couldn't apply for jobs.
Yeah.
As people like, oh, people who are homeless, they should just, you know, earn some money. And I'm like, they can't. You literally cannot apply. There are most jobs you cannot apply for without a known address. And if you don't give one, or if they find that you've given a false one or a public box or something like that, you won't get the job because you're not seen as reliable.
Yeah, absolutely. And so the attitude of, oh, get a job, stop begging, is ridiculous, because they literally are at catch 22 there.
Yeah.
But there is nothing they can do. And, you know, it's the lack of status as well. You're considered to be somebody, however modest your home, your pile of bricks or whatever it is, you are considered to be somebody and have some status, to be a person who's worth paying attention to and treating well within, depending on who you're talking to. As long as you have that. The minute you don't have that, you've lost all status. You've become a dreg, basically. And most people will treat you that way. And I think a lot of it is the fact that it engenders a certain amount of fear, because none of us want to admit the fact that we could become homeless.
No.
That they're not actually different. That is actually just a dark mirror we're looking into. And it's not very pleasant. But it could as easily be us.
Yeah. And the other thing about homelessness is that it's not necessarily also just about a roof above your head. There are cases, people have said, where a homeless person has been given a roof over the head via some form of charity, and they've chosen to return to the streets. And people say, oh, I don't understand, you know, they've gotten all of this. And it's actually because of the because they've been ostracized.
Yeah.
You know, I heard an account, for the life of me, I cannot remember where I heard it or who it was from, but it stuck in my mind, of just someone saying, well, yeah, at least out in the street, I could nod to someone else. You know, I could talk to people. But they were just in this home, and that was it. The only company up until that point who'd cared about them, who'd sort of, you know, taken any interest, who'd been there for them, were other homeless people. And so this woman just suddenly found herself alone, with no friends, in a very cold, very lonely environment. And, you know, if you're living in a, if you say you have a home, but you don't have any decorations, you know, you can't afford any decorations, you can't afford to make it nice, you can't afford to make it homely, and you're all on your own, it's like being in a prison cell. That's not a home. And after years and years on the streets, if you've built up a community, you know, that can start to feel like the only, that can start to feel like home, even if the situation is desperate.
Yeah, and there is also worth bearing in mind that, which is something else that Shelter does, is looks at sort of reasonable places, places that are reasonably priced to rent, and whether they are actually fit to be lived in. And yeah, a lot of them aren't. There was a woman who came into the library recently who, she'd fallen down what we call the digital skills gap. And basically what's happening is the digital skills gap, where someone can't use a computer, is the new illiteracy. So where before, right, and we do still have adults who are illiterate and can't read and write, but now if you can't use a computer, because filling in forms and contacting your local council and getting tax credits or universal credit or anything like that, any sort of aid you need, because it's almost all done online now, if you don't have digital skills, then you become an unperson almost, because you cannot, yeah, access the help you need. So one of the things we do at work is actually help people with this thing, these things. And this woman came in with a baby in a pushchair, and she was trying to get a council house, and she was a single mother. She didn't have a job. The baby was so young, she probably couldn't have left it anyway, and she couldn't afford to pay anyone to look after it. So she was after a council house, but they absolutely wouldn't accept her details via fax. They wanted an email attachment. She didn't have an email address, didn't know how to use a computer. And the house she was living in had a hole in the floor from the upstairs to the downstairs. She had a baby, Christ, that was just learning to crawl. The walls were absolutely black with mould, and one of the windows had been smashed out and replaced with cardboard. So, you know, it wasn't fit to be lived in, this leaky house.
Mm.
But they wouldn't move her until they had this one piece of documentation. So that's the thing, the way everyone sort of talks about how great technology is, and in a lot of ways it is, but it's leaving people behind.
Yeah.
And it's adding to this whole issue of people living in unsafe environments and homelessness. And having home, having a roof over your head, is just basically one of the most basic requirements. You know, whether it's a tent or whether it is just a little shed somewhere, it is a basic requirement.
Yeah, it is. It's something that we don't just want. It's something that is needed.
Yeah,
and it's something that everybody deserves as well. Especially, you know, we call ourselves a first world country. We really shouldn't have hope such. We shouldn't have any homelessness at all, but we certainly shouldn't have it to this degree.
No, absolutely. And then when you think about, we're going to multiply that scale and think about large scale migration and diaspora, and we'd hear about certain presidents, shall we say, talking about tightening up immigration laws when people perhaps decide they don't want to be raising their children in an environment where they could go to get a loaf of bread and get beheaded, or, you know, be bombed out of their homes on any given day.
Yeah.
So they try to move somewhere where that's not happening. And I'm not saying there aren't problems and there aren't culture clashes, and that in some cases there isn't a medieval mindset that isn't really compatible with the slightly more progressive Western view. But those are things that could be addressed. So to have people sort of upping the drawbridge and saying, no, we don't want you here, I mean, what, yeah, you're saying there is you're homeless, and therefore we don't want you, because it is a different type of homelessness, just on a grander scale. And the same thing has happened over the centuries with the Jews, for example, and the Irish during the potato famine and after that. There was a, yeah, lot of immigration to America and to England. And America kind of gets a bit sort of funny if you mention it now, but it wasn't that long ago that that a lot of shops had signs on the doors saying no dogs, no blacks, no Irish.
Yeah.
Because they didn't want people immigrating, coming and taking the jobs, which is not really how it works.
No. And you're right. It is homelessness. That's what it is. That's what it all comes down to. Because you get migrants and then you get expats.
Yeah.
People say, well, expats are just the white people. I'm like, no, expats aren't just the white people. It's just that, yeah, a majority of the people who term themselves to be expats probably are white. But it's all to do with money. If you can afford to come into a country already with a job or afford a property there and still have ties in your home country, you're an expat. If you've been chased out, are in desperate need of help, you know, or have fled violence.
Or you just literally cannot make a living where you can feed yourself, even exactly. just yourself, in your own country, which is obviously what happened during the Irish potato famine.
Yeah.
Then, yeah, as you say, you're a migrant.
Yeah. And it is, it's homelessness. And it's the idea, and homelessness and poverty obviously go hand in hand. But it's the idea that people below a certain bracket, if you don't own property, if you don't have that kind of money, you're worth less.
Yeah, it is, once again, it's the status thing. Yeah. The irony being with, I mean, we're not brilliant over here. We're slightly better than some places, but we're not absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, we're a pretty racist country.
We're actually one of the more tolerant countries.
Yeah, but...
I'm not saying it doesn't happen at all. Yeah, and perhaps historically, that's why we're probably slightly better than a lot of places now. Just like, you know, Germany can hardly hold its hand up and say, oh, you know, we've always been really, really tolerant and open-minded, but because they actually learn their own history, they tend to be one of the better countries.
Yeah.
Whereas
France is so horrifically racist. And I say that with, I love France, you know, that's my mother country, but, like, my God, so yeah. racist.
Well, I don't know enough. I've never lived in France, so I don't know. I've only been a few times. But, say, America, for example, the irony being is they are all immigrants, so at varying yeah. levels.
Yeah. The only people who... yeah, you've got the Native Americans who are just there like, at these rallies, like, oh, I'll send these migrants back. Like, yeah, off you go then. Seriously.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's sort of going over homelessness and, you know, the massive homelessness of sort of immigration, large-scale immigration, rather. Mm. Let's look at the concept of home versus the quest story or the hero's journey and get back onto the speculative fiction side
yeah.
a bit more.
Well, I think we should probably mention Lord of the Rings to begin.
Yeah, I have got that down. But, you know, just as a quick pop quiz, if you like, a lot of quest stories, they have various things, obviously. But there are quest stories that are someone searching for a home. Someone mm-hmm. is trying to save a home. Someone is serving a home that they can never return to. Finding yeah. a home. That's the end destination. Their goal is to find somewhere to belong. Discovering home wasn't actually your home in the first place, but you found somewhere better. Yep. Unable to return home. Trying to get home. And yeah, basically home is belonging and home is other people. And these themes turn up in the hero's journey or the quest arc so often. And as you say, Lord of the Rings is an excellent example. And The Hobbit on a smaller scale is too.
Yeah. The interesting thing about Lord of the Rings is that if we look at it from the point of view of Frodo, returning home, the place that he once belonged to because of the events that happened, no longer feels like home to him.
Yeah, and he did what he did largely, not just because it was right, but also because he couldn't stand the thought of what would happen to the Shire and his home, the place he belonged, if nobody yeah. acted. And it's something that also motivates Sam. But Sam manages to come back from that journey because he hasn't had to carry the ring all the way. Frodo's been yeah. so changed by the actual journey itself that he no longer belongs to the place that he called home. And it's really tragic.
It is. It is incredibly sad. But it is interesting, because usually we think of home as a place that will accept you no matter what. And I quite like the idea that sometimes actually home is as much to do with the kind of person you are as it is to do with just this blind acceptance. And that home can change. Home is not necessarily one place. And that a place that you love for years and years and years and would go to the ends of the earth for isn't necessarily the place that you're going to be able to return to later.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at Lord of the Rings from, say, Aragorn's perspective, he is effectively homeless all throughout that and has been for about 80 years because he's old. He's one of the Dunedain.
Super old.
Super, super old. That's one of the funniest bits of Lord of the Rings. And it's the culmination of Return of the King is obviously the Return of the King, funnily enough. But, you know, it's him going back to the place that was his birthright and his home.
Yeah.
Which is obviously Gondor.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, when we get to... Game of Thrones. We have a similar kind of thing with Dany.
Yeah.
And Daenerys, rather, who's supposed to be, you know, the ruler of Westeros. And yet, Dany doesn't actually feel any real attachment to Westeros at all.
Well, no, she does. Cause
not in the beginning. She says, I want to go home to her brother.
I don't think she really...
And home, she doesn't know where home is, but when at the very early on she says, I want to go home, and her brother's saying, what do you think I'm trying to do? And when he says home, he means Westeros. But when she says home, she's thinking of the place where she spent a lot of her childhood with a person who used to hide them. And she remembers, I think it's a red door and stuff like that. That's home to her. And her kind of... She doesn't really, I think, look at Westeros as home for a while, because she does keep kind of moving between places and trying to find herself first.
Yeah, well, I mean, that her story arc is one long quest arc for a home, ultimately. And she happens to be a conqueror on the way. But she does talk...
Is this home? Well, I'll take it just in case.
I mean, she does talk a little bit as she gets a bit older, how she does feel a connection to the land there, and that she wants to go back to the place where she was born. And maybe you find out, you know, in the books that have not yet been released, that actually she gets there and thinks, this doesn't feel like home. I thought it would do because I was born here, but it doesn't feel like home to me.
Yeah, we don't actually know how she feels about Westeros at all.
Which would be, you know, quite sad really, but perhaps she's somebody who never really feels at home anywhere. The world is her home, kind of thing.
Yeah. See, but it is interesting, another aspect of the loss of home for Daenerys is the fact that she jumps from culture to culture, and she kind of adopts them as she goes. You know, because obviously she starts off as they're very obviously, you know, that they're from Westeros, and then she's part of the Dothraki. And then, you know, they take over these different places and she kind of has to sort of bring them in to her. You know, everything changes constantly. They are constantly on the move. They're not, but it's not just an element of being nomadic. She's forced to change. She's forced to change her clothes. She's forced to change, you know, her approach and things like that. And even though she tries to stick to her morality, she ends up in all sorts of different positions, which, again, I can't say enough how closely home and identity are linked to one another.
Yeah, absolutely. To be honest, that chameleonic ability of hers to adapt to different cultures is part of her survival strategy as well. Yeah. You know, that's what makes her a talented conqueror.
Yeah. But I think it also confuses her a little bit. Because she doesn't head for Westeros straight away. She kind of feels like, no, I've got a duty here. And it takes a little while before, I mean, it takes 7 books before she's like, right, I guess now's the time.
No, you know, you don't get an army and fully grown dragons overnight, and not to mention a navy. Yeah, anyway, serving a home. I always think, I can't remember the name of the boy in Princess Mononoke. Is it Ashitaka?
I think so. Ashitaka. Ashitaka?
Ashitaka. I'm sure it's Ashitaka. Anyway, he was happily, you can see at the very beginning of the film, Princess Mononoke, that he's happy, it's his home. And yet he gets infected by the demon-y stuff. And the best thing, he knows he's going to die because there's no cure for it. And the best thing he can do is go away from his home and serve it by trying to find, you know, what's causing this pollution and hopefully stopping it before it reaches his home.
Sorry, that it always makes me laugh because it starts off, he's got a sister, she's like, "Don't forget us," and he's like, "I'll never forget you," and then he's like, "Well, by the way, here's the gift my sister gave me, you can have it now. Da-da-da, I guess I'll just stay here," and I'm like, dude, just completely just went, did I come from somewhere before? He like does a 180 and just basically abandons where he's from.
I don't think he does, though, does he? Because, that you know, sacrificing a home where you've been happy and taking, you know, the damage away with you and trying to root it out, that, you know, it's a big sacrifice. Yeah, he's serving his home the best way he can.
Yeah, but he could have gone back at the end.
Well, no, because they made him an outcast, didn't they?
They did, yeah.
And said he couldn't ever return. So, you know, that's kind of final.
Yeah. But did they say he could never return? Is it, or just while he's infected he can't return?
But they don't think there's ever any a cure for it, so it's effectively final.
Sure, he could have turned up and said, "Hey guys, I'm cute." Anyway, the point is, it's semantics. It still makes me laugh.
I'm going to say, there's something wrong with you if anything about Princess Mononoke makes you laugh.
There's lots to laugh about in Princess Mononoke. It's hilarious. Anyway. Moving on.
Yeah, anyway, discovering home wasn't your home. I think it's weirdly one of my favourite quest tropes is someone who's like, "I've got to get home, I've got to get home, I've been sucked away from my real home and into this land where nothing makes sense and I need to get home." And then they get to the point where they can get home and they suddenly realise, "I don't want to go home anymore, I belong here." And I love that.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's really painful because it's a case of, no, you have to go home now and you go to a home that you will never ever belong to again.
Which Hooray! Kind of sucks.
But I'm thinking of Louise Lawrence's Landor series where basically these three children, I say children, they're about 16, 17, all get sucked into what appears to be a magical parallel Wales.
Excellent.
And the theme underneath these three books is the fact that the land calls who the land needs. And the reason they've been taken away from their home and started this epic, we've got to get home, quest arc, where they go through one magical doorway into Landor and then have to find their way back by finding another magical doorway, is the fact that they're required. They're going to find their own place in this land. And the fairy woman who helps them initially sort of like, yeah, you're never going home. But she doesn't tell them this because she knows they won't accept it. So she sends them off on a quest. Lots of things happen. Horrible things happen. And gradually the three of them realise that, no, they're never going home. That's it. They're lost to 1970s UK. Because actually where they're needed is here. They found their purpose.
Yeah.
And it sounds really sad, and in a lot of ways it is quite sad, and there's some really poignant bits, but it's such a good trilogy. It's really undersung as well. I don't think many people have heard of it.
No, I certainly haven't heard of it.
I think it's out of print now, but anyway, if you come across, like, the second-hand books, then you should totally read them, because it's awesome.
It makes me think, it's kind of similar with Narnia, and obviously they're not actually looking for home when it comes to Narnia. But Narnia is sort of about the displacement of home, because it starts with these four kids who've been removed from their home during the Blitz. They end up somewhere strange, and then they end up somewhere even stranger, and they end up belonging.
Yeah, they basically go from one war into another war.
Exactly, and they belong there, and they stay there for a very long time. For years, they grow up, and then suddenly they find themselves back in their old world. And it is interesting that in, I like that they did this in the films, and it's alluded to in the books, just the sense that in the second one, there, the Prince Caspian, there's this sense of displacement from all of them, where they just feel like they're struggling to readjust to life back on Earth, because they've, you know, they spent so long in Narnia. They had identities in Narnia. They had, Narnia was their home.
Well, yeah, they were kings and queens.
Kings, yeah, they were kings and queens. That, you know, they didn't just belong there. It was, you know, they were needed there. And then when they end up back in Narnia, they end up in this weird position where everything's changed and the home that they knew is gone. And you get the sense that it takes them a while again to feel a sense of belonging, which is why I always feel really kind of sorry for Susan, because Susan basically goes, yeah, I've found my place where I belong on Earth. And, you know, she kind of gets demonized for it.
Yeah, how dare she want to grow up and have sex and wear lipstick? I mean, I think the thing is, the reasons, because it starts to happen, she starts to reject Narnia in Prince Caspian. And then, you know, Aslan basically takes her and Peter aside at the end of Prince Caspian and says, you're never coming back here. Which, you know, it's like, why do you keep taking me out of my real life when I readjust and then bringing me back here, making me do shit, and then rejecting me again? And I think that's why she rejects it so thoroughly and refuses to talk about it. Because imagine if you'd been literally taken into a magical land and you'd really found your place and your purpose there, and you'd lived for the land and you'd served it, and then it just rejects you. And then it just keeps doing the same thing over and over again. You'd be kind of like, well, fuck you very much then, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you can totally understand where Susan's coming from. Because this is a girl who was displaced from an incredibly young age. It has terrible psychological influence. If the place that you feel, and the person that you're supposed to trust as well, they're supposed to trust Aslan. They're supposed to be able to trust him. And yet, he keeps toying with them in this way.
Yeah,
and he just says, like, well, you need to have faith, and it's not kind. You can kind of understand where she says, actually, I want to grow up. I want to find a sense of purpose. I want to go home.
I want to have one life and not live between two worlds. Because there's a sense that with the other children, no matter how devoted they are to Narnia, etc., that they never really quite find their place in their own world. And it's kind of like, well, screw you, Jesus Lion allegory, you know? And then the bit that always got me, that made me, the first time I read The Last Battle, I was kind of like really uncomfortable with the idea that the children and their children's parents, everyone, in fact, except Susan, dies in a train crash. And Susan's like, so I guess I'm the last one left then. And they're all supposed to be like, oh, well, she rejected Narnia. So it's, you know, it's sad, but we won't be too upset about it. Let's all go on to heaven together. It's like she's had her entire family taken away from her.
That's really something.
Yeah. So there's a couple of big plot holes in Narnia, the Chronicles of Narnia. I do really like them still. They're probably getting a bit dated in a lot of respects. And C.S. Lewis probably hadn't had his slightly old-fashioned bachelor ideas challenged enough until, obviously, he got married himself.
Yeah.
At that point, at the point he wrote them. So that does come out in the text, I think. But it's still a bit sort of, what the hell? Anyway, the trying to get home arc. I think it's really interesting in Narnia that they never at any point, they're kind of like, oh, there's a magical land in the wardrobe, let's just keep going. Nobody tries to get home. Nobody ever tries to get home.
But again, I feel I get that sense that the reason they don't try to get home is that they feel like their home is gone. And you think about the psychology of what was happening in the war. They were being sent off and they were seeing this absolute destruction. It wasn't just that the families were dying. You know, their homes were literally being destroyed. Entire streets were being levelled. You can kind of understand that the sense that they... Maybe the reason they were so eager to fall into Narnia was because they were looking for a home now, because their home had been taken from them.
And that's a good point. That was something that is well documented amongst those who were evacuated during the war, Second World War, obviously. And I've spoken to people who were evacuees, and there's one lady in particular, and I think this is quite representative of quite a few. She used to live in a city, and she was evacuated out to the Cotswolds, where she lived on a farm. And she completely fell in love with this place as a child. So when she was sent back to the city, it wasn't home anymore.
Yeah.
And she was just really desperately miserable and unhappy with, you know, she'd been one child who were loved by this old childless couple on a farm, which sounds like something out of a fairy story, but that's what happened. And then she went back home where there were eight other children in one of the little sort of tenements in London. And a mother who didn't have time for all of them, and a father who was, you know, half at work, half drunk. And she was just miserable. And obviously, she obviously got back to the Cotswolds, otherwise I probably wouldn't have been talking to her in a library when she was celebrating her 92nd birthday. But, you know, this is something that happened. And I know not all evacuation stories were happy, and that bad things happened to some of the children who were evacuated. But again, it's that same sense of being dislocated from your home.
Yeah. And it's no wonder, actually, then, that during that period we get a lot of literature which is about finding home and the destruction of home and about the destruction of identity as well.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. It was such a major roadblock, I suppose, in a lot of people's lives, particularly, you know, especially evacuees.
Yeah. So do you feel that you've explored home as a theme within your own work, Jules?
Yes, I suppose so, but not not deliberately. I mean, obviously setting almost as a character in its own right is really important to me, as you can probably tell.
Yes.
But the character who most embodies the idea of what home is and where to belong is Kieran, probably.
Yeah.
Because when you start off, particularly if you read things in his point of view, he doesn't really belong anywhere, and he's restless, and I don't think he realises that he's sort of looking for this place to belong, not realising that his place to belong really is with a set of people who can meet him on the same level.
Yeah.
And don't take too much of his crap. but yeah, because for him, just being in the great outdoors is kind of home, and anything else is a bit confining.
Yeah.
So indirectly, yes, I have. But nobody's really gone on a quest for home arc. And certainly other characters are kind of like, home is where you make it. Like Grace really makes a home down in Cornwall, because that's where she decides she wants to belong. M sort of decides she belongs wherever she wants to be.
M's like, I will belong wherever the hell I want to belong.
Yeah, the problem with M is that she moves in and everything dead in the area goes, oh my god, we're being evicted. And then when she's cleared them all out, she's kind of like, yep, this is mine.
Rude, M.
Possibly super not the greatest rude example in that respect.
Just going in, evicting the dead, taking over. Super rude. Well, I've definitely written about finding about home.
You've also written about homelessness.
I have written about homelessness. When did I write about homelessness? Right.
You know when. Who did I do that horrible thing to? Oh, was it Rufus? Was it Rufus?
Could it have been Rufus and Joshua? Yeah, that doesn't come back to bite them later on. It does. Anyway, sorry. Yeah, you're right. You're totally right. And that is actually part of Joshua's story arc later on, is that he suddenly is like, oh god, I've got to be king of Hamartia. I've never been to Hamartia.
I've never stayed in one place for longer than 5 minutes. What am I doing?
I mean, he lived a bit in Corlum, but Corlum is so close to the Bithynian border.
Yeah.
It's practically Bithyne. So he has no real sense of Hamartia. He's never been to the city. He has no real connection with the people there or anything like that. So he's suddenly like, oh god, I've got to be king of these people. No wonder they're rejecting me. They don't know who I am. And I don't know who they are. And... yeah, but it was kind of similar for Yonat, is that he suddenly felt that he didn't belong in Hamartia. He needed to be somewhere else. Mostly because someone was trying to kill him, so understandable.
You know, that'll do it.
Yeah. But the book that I'm writing, which where the main theme is actually about home, is my children's book, Anise Starr.
Yeah.
Where the character Anise finds out that her home, her physical home, is threatened. It's going to be demolished. She's going to be moved out and sent to a horrible boarding school called Millport. I have no idea where I got that name from. No idea at all. I mean, I went to boarding schools. One was called Port Regis, the other was called Millfield, but I have no idea where I got the name Millport from. Anyway, so she's absolutely horrified, and she kind of goes on this very risky journey to save her home from being demolished. And then during this journey, she kind of realizes that home isn't actually just this house. And the reason she really wants to save the house is that it's the only part of her mother that she has left.
Yeah.
But actually, she kind of, so it's actually about, it's about, you know, letting go of trauma and taking a step back, because in trying to save her home, she actually puts things at risk, which are her real home, and that her real home is her companion and her guardian, Wolf, and the friends that she makes along the way. And the world that she lives in, the responsibility that she has, and she kind of realizes that she doesn't need the bricks to still feel like she belongs somewhere, because she wasn't, a home wasn't actually a place, it was a people. And that's kind of ultimately what the book is about. It's a rather sad book, actually. I mean, it's happy, but like, on reflection...
The actual theme is quite sad. The weird thing was, in my list, I've got an example for almost all of the little sort of types of home quest arc I've written down, and I've got trying to save a home, and I couldn't think of an example. I'm like, I've read a book that covers this recently. Why can't I remember? Of course, it's your book, isn't it? It's like, because it hasn't been published yet, so I just can't.
Fingers crossed someday.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm glad you filled in that gap for me, because I was starting to think I'd gone mad.
You're welcome!
Before we close, I'm just going to talk a little bit about Wind in the Willows.
Yes, excellent.
And Wind in the Willows, I think one of its sub-themes is very much, where is home? The way that homes are presented in that, so quietly but so importantly, I mean, the story starts with Mole doing a little bit of household maintenance, and he just gets really fed up of it and gets called by the great outdoors. And he's our viewpoint character. We follow Mole through all his adventures. And there's, I think part of it is he's learning to be satisfied with the home he's got. Mm. And it's really quite poignant when he gets to that point. But he goes and stays with Rat in the riverbank. And it... Rat, you know, Rat's home's really described, and then when they get lost in the woods, they find Badger's set, and Badger takes them in, and they stay with him for a little bit, and then obviously go back to Rat's again. And Toad Hall, the grandeur of Toad Hall, and the fact that Toad Hall gets taken away from Toad because, you know, Toad's in a motor vehicle accident, which is his own fault, and gets sent to prison. So the Weasels take over Toad Hall, and there's a big fight scene where Badger and Rat and Mole go in with cudgels and beat up the weasels to get them out. It sounds really bad, doesn't it? Beat up the weasels to get them out of Toad Hall. And the point is that nowhere else is right for each animal. It's home and identity again. Where your home is important for you. Of course, Rat's been really happy just having Mole live with him as a roommate, and not realising that Mole's all this time being quite a retiring little creature. He's been kind of like longing for his own home, and he's almost forgotten that he had his own home. And then they pass it one day when they're walking, and he still gets a little bit of whiff of home and wants to turn that way, but Rat overrules him. And it's only when he realizes how much Mole needs to go to his own home as well that they go back there. And I'm not telling this very well, but it's really amazingly poignant, particularly for a children's book as well. The depth that it goes into, the fact that you need your place to belong.
Yeah. You need a place where you can feel safe. And I not just physically safe, but actually safe as in There's company with whom you can not just be yourself. You can be the worst part of yourself. You can even be, you know, the quietest part of yourself and still feel comfortable. The place where you can sit in silence for hours on end without having to worry about the repercussions of that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. But it makes me feel a bit heartsick, actually, this discussion. It brings on this sense of longing. Because I think there's also a sense that I think all of us are looking for home at some point in our lives. And sometimes at several points in our lives, we suddenly go, where is home? In both the physical sense and the emotional sense, as friends move in and out of our lives and people pass on and other people come in and, you know, job opportunities may take us further afield. It's very peculiar, but when home for my parents ended up being Syria, despite the fact one was French and the other was English, and then it was Bangladesh and Egypt and, you know, the Middle East, that became home. And yet for other people, home is the place where they were born, the place that their parents were born, and they will marry in the same church that their parents did and their grandparents did, and that's home, and that's a powerful bond. It just depends on the person. And on that forlorn note, I say it's not forlorn, but you know what I mean.
Yes. We should probably be wrapping this up. It's a huge topic.
It is a huge topic, and I'm sure we'll probably come back to it again at some point in the future. But for the time being, it's time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And Jules, I believe you've got one for us.
Yes. Yesterday I finished a book called The Salt Path, which is not speculative fiction, so holding my hands up to that now. It's by Raina Wynne, and it's non-fiction as well. It's biographical, and it's about a couple who lose their house and their livelihood and their home in a court case, which looks like, you know, it had some seriously dodgy elements to it, to be honest. And right. They're basically left homeless and penniless in their 50s, and then they find out that the husband of the pair actually has a degenerative brain disorder.
Oh, Christ.
And may only have 5 or 6 years to live. Now, this all sounds really bleak, but it's not. It's one of the most hopeful, uplifting books I've ever read. Because what they do is buy themselves a tent on eBay and decide to walk the Southwest Coast Path, which is 636 miles long, and it goes from Minehead to Poole in Dorset. This book is all about how they do it and how hard it is to start with, and yet how much it improves his health and well-being and his mental state and how they heal from this terrible blow, because this whole court battle and that resulted in them losing everything has come from a friend taking them to court. So there's a massive betrayal there too. But this really, really long walk just does this sort of transformative spiritual healing on them almost. And it's a really amazing story. I highly recommend it.
Oh, that's brilliant. Really interesting.
Yeah.
And I may have to check that out.
It's told in a way that's open and slightly tongue-in-cheek and humorous and still quite poignant. So it's not a case of, oh, this happened and this happened and everything was bleak. It's not like reading Cormac McCarthy's The Road or anything, you know? Which is, I got to the end of that, I was just like, okay, well, I don't want to do anything now, you know? Whereas this is very different. It's very hopeful.
Okay, that's brilliant. Well, readers. Sorry, I did readers. A whole... I did a Jane Eyre there. Reader, I married him.
Reader, I well, murdered
on that
him.
Note, reader, that's what you wanted to happen, but that's not what happened. That's what I wish had happened in Wuthering Heights. And then they all died. Yay!
They very nearly all did in Fenn.
Yeah, I know, but like they didn't all die, and I really wish all of them had died. Every single one of them. Miserable bunch. Anyway, and on that note, guys, with this request for death, I say to you all, farewell, and I will catch up with you soon.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye!
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.